see. You have a great rest of your day. I'll catch you next time.
You don't usually see white supremacist propaganda on government websites, but that's what this really is.
The White House is promoting its immigration crackdown with memes, and some look a lot like white nationalist content.
Today is Tuesday, August 19th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. As part of the administration's immigration crackdown, leaders have been urging people to self-deport.
Next, we'll meet someone from Kenya who decided to take that path.
This is the safest option that I had on the table for me. But also, it's the decision that's probably going to hurt me the most.
Later, the U.S. Open is a redemption of sorts for top-ranked women's doubles player Taylor Townsend.
I've always been this person, but I think for some years I was lost, you know, and lost in a sea of a lot of stuff.
Plus, a new memoir, The Quiet Ear, An Investigation of Missing Sound.
Now News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Russia says it's open to a meeting among President Vladimir Putin, Ukraine's leader Volodymyr Zelensky, and possibly President Trump. But the Kremlin has remained vague on the timing of the summit. NPR's Charles Maines reports the White House says it's hoping the talks will lead to peace in Ukraine.
In an interview on state television, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow was not refusing any format of meetings, be they between Putin and Zelensky or eventually including President Trump. Yet Lavrov warned preparations for such events take time. His comments suggested Moscow was looking to slow walk Trump's calls for a Putin-Zelensky meeting in the coming days or weeks. Trump says Putin agreed to the bilateral talks to be followed by a trilateral meeting, including Trump, following a phone call he placed to the Russian leader Monday. Kremlin aide Yuri Ushakov was more circumspect, saying only Moscow was considering the possibility of holding higher-level direct talks with Ukraine. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
Lawmakers in Texas are gearing up to vote on a redistricting bill tomorrow to ensure that Democrats stick around. The Speaker of the House is requiring all members who broke quorum to sign off on having a police escort. Blaise Gainey from the Texas Newsroom reports one House Democrat is refusing to do so.
Representative Nicole Collier says she's used to long days working in the Texas legislature, but she hasn't left the House floor since session began Monday afternoon. She says while her Democratic colleagues signed the slip allowing themselves to be monitored by state law enforcement officers until Wednesday's session, doing so didn't feel right with her.
I feel like that is an invasion of my rights as a person, and it's dehumanizing and demeaning, and I just won't take it. I won't agree to it.
The vote to pass the redistricting bill is slated for Wednesday. It would give Republicans a leg up in five Democratic districts they are trying to flip. Once that passes, Collier believes the House Speaker will no longer require DPS escorts for quorum breakers. I'm Blaise Gainey in Austin.
Home building activity picked up last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on the latest figures from the Commerce Department.
Builders broke ground on 5.2% more homes in July than they did the month before. Construction of single-family homes jumped nearly 3% last month. Building permits, which are considered a guide to future construction plans, offered a more mixed picture. Permits for single-family homes rose slightly last month, while permits for multifamily housing fell. A survey shows many home builders are still gloomy about the housing market, with elevated mortgage rates keeping a lot of would-be buyers on the sidelines. Home Depot says its sales picked up in the most recent quarter, but the home improvement chain's sales and profits still fell short of what analysts had expected. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
At the close on Wall Street, the Dow was up 10 points. This is NPR News in Washington. The Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. is embroiled in a dispute over face masks. NPR's Anastasia Seleukis reports.
More than 800 Kennedy Center employees and their supporters are calling on the institution to reverse its ban on masks for employees. The anti-mask policy was introduced this April by Richard Grenell, who was appointed president of the Kennedy Center earlier this year. President Trump is its current chair. In a press release, unionized employees at the Kennedy Center say that workers have routinely been denied exemptions to the no-mask policy, including those with documented health concerns. The group also says that masked Kennedy Center employees have experienced, quote, disciplinary action, lost wages, reassignment, surveillance, and intimidation. Anastasia Tsiolkas, NPR News, New York.
Nearly a dozen major foundations in the U.S. are pledging about $37 million in emergency funding relief to public media stations at risk of shutting down after losing federal funding. The donors include the Ford Foundation and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, many of them longtime NPR supporters. They warn if stations go dark, millions of Americans could lose access to trusted news, cultural programs, and local information. Congress recently voted to reverse more than 2 years' worth of federal funding it had approved for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com.
It is 6 minutes after 4 o'clock. Thank you for listening to KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Partly cloudy tonight and foggy, lows in the upper 50s. Areas of dense fog in the morning, otherwise mostly sunny, highs near 81 and calm winds. Looking ahead to Thursday, mostly sunny, highs 80 to 85, slight chance for afternoon showers in the Bemidji area. Coming up at 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. We continue with All Things Considered.
From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Trump administration is promoting its aggressive immigration crackdown with memes and other statements, of course. But on X and social media, the White House and the Department of Homeland Security post a steady stream of images and videos. Sometimes they use viral trends in an attempt to frame deportations as comedy. Other posts are similar to content found in white supremacist circles. NPR's Shannon Bond and Jude Joffe Block have been looking at these posts and looking into what they say. Good to have you both here.
Hello.
Hi, Ari.
For those who don't follow these accounts, tell us about what they've been posting.
Well, let's take one example from last month. There's a viral TikTok trend that uses audio from a British airline ad. It sounds like this. Darling,
hold my hand. Nothing beats a Jet 2 holiday. And right now, you can
And people have been pairing this sound with videos of their travel mishaps to be funny. The White House made its own video with this audio, but paired it with footage of handcuffed immigrants boarding deportation flights. And this is emblematic of some of the themes we see with these posts, trying to use mass deportations as fodder for jokes, joining in on viral internet trends, and trolling critics.
And in the last several weeks, many of these posts we're seeing, they've really focused on this big push that DHS is doing to recruit more ICE agents. So those range from World War II style recruitment posters to artwork evoking nostalgic versions of America's past. And also videos like this one, which uses audio from the opening monologue from the 2022 movie, The Batman.
They think I'm hiding in the shadows, but I am the shadows.
And the video shows armed border agents in military-style fatigues and helmets in action. A Bible verse appears on the screen. And the caption addresses what they call criminal illegal aliens and warns they're an existential threat to Americans and will be hunted down.
There's a lot going on there. So what is your sense of who the intended audience is for these posts?
Well, the White House and DHS, for the most part, did not engage when we asked them specific questions about this posting strategy. The White House did give us a statement saying it, quote, consistently posts banger memes. But communications experts we spoke with say there are a couple potential audiences here. So to some degree, this seems to be about generating outrage from the left, especially for people who are very online and will get these kind of references. They can also serve to normalize ideas that people would otherwise consider extreme. We spoke to Ryan Milner, who studies internet culture at the College of Charleston.
It speaks to the people who enjoy the irreverence, who enjoy the cruelty, who enjoy owning the libs, the kind of gleeful pushing forward of this kind of America First agenda, and especially how it causes people to freak out and cry foul. I think that's part of the point with these.
And then there are the posts appealing to people for the purposes of ICE recruitment. And that's apparent in those more aggressive videos showing immigration enforcement in action. They're depicting policing the border as a battle between good and evil, complete with these biblical references. And there are also posts that present this very nostalgic, white-centric vision of the American past that serve to illustrate the Trump administration's idea of who belongs in this country. Like when DHS posted an 1872 painting called American Progress, it shows a blonde angelic female figure in a white gown leading the way as settlers move across the land and Native Americans and bison make way. And this work is closely associated with the concept of manifest destiny, which is the belief that white settlers were destined by God to expand across the North American continent. And this is a very contested, violent, and painful part of American history. Yet DHS's caption on the painting reads, "A heritage to be proud of, a homeland worth defending." We asked DHS about this post, and spokesperson Tricia McLaughlin gave us a statement that said in part, quote, "This administration is unapologetically proud of American history and American heritage. Get used to it."
Now, your reporting has also found some other posts that resemble white supremacist content. Tell us about those.
Right. So as Jude said, many of these posts present this very white-centric past. They include calls to defend that vision of America, with captions including "secure the golden age" and "protect, serve, deport." And in some cases, they seem to reference extremist ideas. Like DHS recently posted an image of Uncle Sam at a crossroads captioned, "Which way, American man?" That phrase is similar to a meme sometimes used by right-wing accounts that borrows the title of a book called Which Way, Western Man. It was written by William Gailey Simpson, a white nationalist. It was published by a neo-Nazi group. It advocates violence against Jews, and it argues Hitler was right. We spoke with Heidi Beirich, who is co-founder of the Global Project Against Hate and Extremism, and she told us this kind of material she usually only sees on far-right extremist corners of the internet.
You don't usually see white supremacist propaganda on government websites, but that's what this really is.
And when we asked DHS about this post, McLaughlin said, quote, "Calling everything you dislike Nazi propaganda is tiresome." She didn't respond to our question about how DHS intends the white-centric imagery it posts to be interpreted.
Lots of the posts you're talking about use work created by other people, paintings, audio, music. How are those creators and artists responding to this?
Well, several artists have put out statements saying their work is being used without their permission, and in some cases, they're pushing back. After the White House posted its video from the Jet to TikTok trend that we mentioned before, the pop star Jess Glynn, whose music is featured in that ad, wrote on Instagram that she felt sick about the White House's post. Now the audio is disabled on the White House's Instagram. We've also seen other Trump administration videos that use music that now say the audio isn't available due to copyright claims.
That's NPR's Jude Jaffe Block and Shannon Bond. Thank you both.
Thanks, Ari.
Thank you.
The other night, a successful immigrant with a family and a good job decided to leave the U.S., his home for nearly two decades. Samuel Kangethe left Michigan and returned to Kenya on his own terms to avoid deportation. He's one of more than 7,000 immigrants who have decided to heed President Trump's orders to, quote, self-deport or face consequences. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran has been following the man's story and was with him during his last few days in the U.S.
It's a Saturday morning, and Samuel Kangethe moves slowly around his house in West Lansing, a neighborhood with big trees and long front yards in Michigan's capital. It's clear people were here last night celebrating.
There was people here, like there was sitting, you can tell by where the confetti is. There were people there last night.
Kangethe is right. Confetti is everywhere in the backyard. Dozens of people drove to his home to say goodbye to him.
So my wife, she had a surprise go away from me, and she got me super emotional because you don't think of this stuff until something happens to you, and then you're kind of like, you know, who can step up for me, or who have you influenced, or how far have you touched people's lives and stuff like that.
Besides cleaning, there are two things on Kangethe's agenda for this day. spending time with his family, and packing. That is because after 16 years in the U.S., he is going back to his home country of Kenya. He's doing it on his own terms, rather than worrying about being picked up by immigration and customs enforcement agents and being detained. He says he has not committed a crime, but a prior marriage was deemed fraudulent in 2014 by federal immigration officials. And because his case is still pending in front of an immigration judge, Kengethe could be deported.
Deportation is like the worst thing that would come from this case. How about if I take myself out as a show of good faith that I can try to take myself out?
He does not want to be a victim, he says. This is accountability, but he hopes to get a chance to return to the U.S. In the meantime, he's leaving his wife of 7 years and their 3 kids, ages 13, 11, and 5. He worries how they'll manage without him. But he has a lot left to pack before he spends the last hours with them.
You know, I just want to take, like, just the clothes that I need before I get settled and all that kind of stuff because, I don't know, there's just too much. I can't bring everything.
He's also bringing with him his golf clubs he bought from Facebook Marketplace, his diplomas from 2 Michigan universities where he got a bachelor's degree in accounting and a master's degree in finance.
I'm just getting my shoes.
And even hair clippers.
I've never shaved my beard. I always go to the barber shop. But I had to get clips because I don't know if I'm going to be able, how long it's going to take for me before I find a good barber shop.
But he's leaving some clothes behind, a way to trick his mind.
In the hopes probably I get to come back or something.
The next day, Kengethe arrives at the Detroit Metro Airport. A group of his closest friends drove him in a red pickup truck, the only vehicle to fit all his bags.
Good luck, man. See you soon.
Inside the airport, he tells me his kids and family decided to stay home.
The reason they didn't come to the airport with me is because it was ugly. It was ugly leaving the house. It was, honestly, to be honest, it was ugly. I felt like I had to run from them because there wasn't enough buys. There wasn't enough hugs.
His youngest daughter, 5-year-old Ella, kept begging him to stay. It's the hardest decision he's made, but he's been preparing for this moment since May, when he decided to leave voluntarily.
This is the safest option that I had on the table for me. So you can imagine, like, this is the safest, but also it's the decision that's probably going to hurt me the most, you know, because it's hurting me. And I feel like it's because of me that the kids are going to be hurting too.
Kengethe is trying to find positivity in all of this, though. He's excited to see his mom in Kenya, to spend time with his siblings, to learn the new landmarks in Nakuru, a city he left 16 years ago.
For me, it has been an absolute privilege to be in this country, like absolute privilege to be in this country. I would love to remain in this country because I feel like, as I said, this is now the place that I found love. And just not just love for my wife, but love for these kids.
The time has come. Kengethe walks through the doors of gate A60. His sister Elizabeth is escorting him back home. An uncertain new life awaits in Kenya, while his family in the U.S. also anxiously waits for the next time they'll see each other. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Detroit Metro Airport.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a moment, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this state. Support comes from the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com. Partly cloudy and foggy overnight with lows in the upper 50s. Fog in the morning, then mostly sunny, highs near 81.
On today's date, August 19th, 2008, I spot a Compton tortoiseshell butterfly. This butterfly more than likely came out from hiding and resting this summer after having emerged from its chrysalis, which was probably in a birch or an aspen, and now is in the process of maybe fattening up just a little bit before winter. The butterfly will find a suitable hiding spot, maybe a pile of wood, maybe a mailbox, maybe your garage, maybe a crack in a tree. At some point, it will spot a suitable place to spend the winter, and it will disappear, but it will remain in its adult stage. And through the winter, it will freeze solid, but thanks to some amazing antifreeze in its body, the tissues won't be harmed. And then along about late March or early April, depending on the spring that we have, the Comptons will emerge, and it will be one of the first butterflies that we will see come spring.
For NPR comes from the station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. When writer Raymond Antrobus was a child, he had a hard time making sense of the world around him. He struggled to hold conversations. He missed instructions from his teachers. He would get sent off to detention. Everyone assumed he had a cognitive disability. Until one day, his mother bought a telephone, a loud phone. When it rang, it was piercing. Everyone in his house seemed to notice but him. That is how Raymond Antrobus learned at 6 years old that he was deaf. Well, he's out with a new memoir called The Quiet Ear, An Investigation of Missing Sound. Raymond, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So to explain to people listening now, you wear hearing aids.
Yes.
You're also able to hear my questions in part because you have closed captioning going across the screen that's capturing
yes.
what I'm saying.
Yes.
You describe this feeling of living in a world of in-betweenness, to use your word, like halfway in the deaf world, halfway in the hearing world, feeling displaced from both. How do you navigate that? How did you learn to navigate it as a kid?
I didn't have any map. I didn't have anything to kind of compare it to because there was no friends or family or network that had a kind of a cultural idea of deafness. So it wasn't actually until much, much later when I kind of connected with a creative deaf community in London and met, you know, deaf actors and dancers and poets and performers that I kind of really found something to, you know, tap into and understand for myself. But there are so many different factors that, you know, that go into developing an identity, race and class, even the way you sign. So, you know, I learned to sign BSL at 11 years old.
British Sign Language.
British Sign Language mm-hmm. is right.
Which is quite different from American.
It is. It has a different root. So American Sign Language is built on French Sign Language because the first deaf families to go over to America from Europe came from France, whereas British Sign Language is an indigenous language. It's more than 500 years old, which is as old as Shakespeare.
I never knew that. I never knew the origins. Huh.
Yeah.
You also write so beautifully about you just nodded to race, to class, the in-betweenness you experienced growing up in London, son of a Jamaican father, a British mm-hmm. mother, a black father, a white mother, mm-hmm. trying to figure out what world is mine.
Yeah. So my dad was a kind of an amateur DJ. So when I was a kid and I wasn't yet able to speak fluently, he would play me poems by dub poets who often themselves were Jamaican and British. And he would ask me to recite these poems and they were in patois. So I could barely speak English and my dad is there trying to get me to recite patois. And then he would just be laughing at all of my attempts. And then he would record me trying to say these words and then he would incorporate some of the poems and some of my attempt at speech into his DJ set.
Ha.
You know, it was a way to make I don't know, fun and lightness of what was a disability, something that everywhere else in my life was looked at as something that I was struggling with or something that I was incapable of. But there was something particularly Jamaican about remixing or creating your own style, your own sound. That's kind of what Jamaica as a culture is very good at.
Yeah. So I do want to ask about, I want to ask about the language that you used to describe your hearing. People always use the term hearing loss. I tell people I have hearing loss, severe to profound hearing loss. You flip it around and write about deaf gain, about living with the aid of deafness. Do you feel that?
I do. So I think about this idea of having a natural deaf disposition. You know, after reading David Wright, a deaf poet from the 1950s and 60s, he in his memoir, he talks a lot about the hindrance and the struggle. But he does there are moments where he kind of touches on this idea that he wouldn't be a poet without his deafness.
Mm.
Like he does credit his deafness for making him a poet. And he even talks about a term from William Wordsworth where he says eye music, as in EYE. And David Wright resonated with this idea of the eye, the music of the eye, the sound of the eye, what you're relying on with the eye. So, yeah, you know, there's so much play with that.
Well, and you've used poetry to explain to the rest of the world how you see the world, how deafness has influenced you. Would you give us a little taste of that? I wonder if you'd read us the first stanza of your poem, Dear Hearing World.
Sure. This is Dear Hearing World, and it's after a poem by Dinesh Smith.
Okay.
I have left Earth in search of sound or orbits, a solar system where the space between a star and a planet isn't empty. I have left a white beard of noise in my place, and many of you won't know the difference. We are indeed the same volume. All of us eventually fade.
Skip ahead, if you would, just give me the last two lines.
The last two lines are, deaf voices go missing like sound in space, and I have left Earth to find them.
I keep turning this over in my head. There's anger in this poem. Mm. The idea that you had to leave Earth to find something you need. Did you speak to that?
I wrote that poem when I revisited the deaf school I went to in North London, Muswell Hill. It was a deaf school that was also part of a hearing school. And those two worlds still felt like they were a true representation of what it was like leaving school and being out in the big world, where I had to function as a hearing person because I've got this clear speech and my hearing aids are quite small, so I can make people forget that I'm a deaf person. I lip read. I'm very sensitive to acoustics of spaces, so I've learned how to navigate sound in this particular way. And it's, you know, a lot of that is a kind of invisible labor in the hearing world. But when you find yourself in deaf spaces where that sensibility is understood, there's like a relaxation that can happen.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
you know? And just to say that what you asked about the anger, like you're right, because I went back to Blanche Neville's, you know, about 14 years after leaving it, and I saw more struggle. I saw smaller classrooms. I realized that had I been growing up at that point, I wouldn't have even got into that school. I wouldn't have been deaf enough to get into that school. There's more deaf schools being closed. There's more deaf people being mainstreamed. And so I had to, you know, speak to that. And a lot of anger is sourced in that.
Raymond Antrobus, he is a poet and author of the new memoir, The Quiet Ear. Thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me. This has been an honor to be heard.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:29. Thank you for listening to All Things Considered on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. In a moment, It is National Native News, and 1 hour from now, the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local stories and conversations at our website, kaxc.org. Donating stocks or mutual funds is an easy way to defend KAXC from funding cuts. You could receive tax benefits as well. Call Sarah for more details, 218-326-1234 during business hours. Partly cloudy overnight with potential for fog, lows in the upper 50s, areas of dense fog in the morning, then mostly sunny, highs tomorrow near 81 with calm winds. For Thursday, mostly sunny, highs 80 to 85, slight chance for afternoon showers in the Bemidji area. You can answer our question of the week. We want to hear about your roommate experiences. Text us 218-326-1234.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On Friday, a federal judge in Phoenix seemingly cleared the way for a massive copper mining project until the Ninth Circuit suddenly stepped in. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, the latest court order came less than 24 hours before Oak Flat inside the Tonto National Forest would have turned into private property.
That pending land exchange between the U.S. Forest Service and Resolution Copper has been put on hold once more, with a temporary administrative injunction issued Monday by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The new order comes after Judge Dominic Lanza denied requests to delay the congressionally authorized land transfer. These pleas came from plaintiffs, including the San Carlos Apache tribe. The tribe called it a last-minute victory, while Resolution Copper is confident the court will ultimately affirm Judge Lanza's, quote, well-reasoned orders. The three-judge panel would not comment on the merits, but noted these appeals will undergo an expedited briefing schedule starting next month. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
State lawmakers are holding a joint hearing Tuesday in Sacramento about the University of California holding Native American human remains and cultural items. Three state audits over the past 5 years show UC fails to return the remains. University officials are expected to respond. Summer is a prime time for gathering and baking camas across the Pacific Northwest, Rockies, and Plains regions. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports on a bake-off recently held outside Eugene, Oregon.
Salette's tribal member Joe Scott heads the Traditional Ecological Inquiry Program under the Long Tom Watershed Council. He described how he'd layer his packets of leaf-wrapped camas bulbs.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to throw the wet sword ferns on top of this. Bunch of water, like a couple of buckets of water after the maple leaves, and then a layer of these skunk cabbage leaves, put the packets on top of that, and then the alder and the ferns and all this stuff right here.
Oh, and there's mugwort, hazel, and bracken ferns in Scott's recipe too. The whole oven hissed with steam once the water hit the hot rocks. Nearby, the TIP senior intern and my kid, Samuel Bull of the Nez Perce tribe, assembled the second oven with mom's help. This was mostly ferns, maple leaves, and camas bundled in skunk cabbage leaves, with some carrots and potatoes thrown in for experimentation's sake, all under canvas and four buckets of water.
Okay, I think that's good.
Yes, I would put the camas closer to the middle. Okay. Those yeah. Right there is great.
Is it cooking?
Yeah.
Flash forward to a day later. Bull decided to do a camas bake for 24 hours. The group peeled back the canvas to reveal glistening and translucent camas bulbs.
Looks good.
Oh, look at those beauties.
Good?
It's really good.
Give me some flavor notes.
Really soft, sweet, and starchy.
Perfect. I'm so happy.
Wow.
And yes, Bull's potatoes and carrots came out well too. Scott's batch baked for nearly 26 hours and had a small fire burning atop his oven for part of that time. At first, there was a little concern as some bulbs were hardened and dark, but then when the rest were unearthed,
they're perfect. Wow. They're like a sweet gumdrop.
The longer bake meant Scott's camas were more caramelized and sweeter. But at the end of the day, Scott said the real success of the event was creating community. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull, near Eugene, Oregon.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com.
Support comes from AirTalk Wireless, where individuals who qualify for the Tribal Lifeline program receive an iPhone or Samsung device, unlimited data, calls and texts, and international calling. Learn more at airtalkwireless.com/NNN.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Capital One with the Capital One Saver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The International Association of Chiefs of Police, one of the nation's largest police organizations, has adopted two resolutions focused on immigration enforcement operations. One talks about the dangers of, quote, inflammatory rhetoric from influential leaders. The other warns that when agents cover their faces, it can, quote, create confusion, fear, and mistrust among community members and responding agencies. It's rare for the organization to make this kind of a statement, and IACP Deputy Executive Director Terrence Cunningham is with us now to explain the thinking behind it. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Hi, Ari. Great to be on. Thank you.
Why did you think it was important to put these out now?
So we heard directly from our members. We're about 35,000 members, that they were really concerned first about the face covering aspect of the first resolution. And then later we also heard about the rise in the incendiary, rhetoric that we're hearing out there, both from politicians and from, community leaders and other folks in the public.
Well, let me ask specifically about the face coverings. Immigration and Customs Enforcement says this is necessary to prevent doxing and assaults on officers. Do they have a point?
Clearly, we have seen a rise in doxing on officers, not just federal agents, but on local officers as well. But from our perspective, from an IACP perspective, we think this is a real slippery slope. From a police legitimacy standpoint, the public needs to know who it is that they're interacting with, whether it's, when you're looking at somebody and having a conversation with them, you can see empathy in their face, you can have a conversation, understand who that person is, you need to be able to identify that person should something happen. We feel strongly that the face coverings are inappropriate in most cases in policing in a democratic society in 2025.
You also, and I'm quoting here, urge public figures to communicate responsibly, especially given the amplifying effect of social media. Can you give us an example of the kind of rhetoric you're concerned about?
There's really, to be honest with you, I actually harken back to 2016 where we saw the five Dallas officers were shot and killed.
But you're putting this out in 2025. There's a lot of inflammatory rhetoric in 2025. Is this specifically about the kinds of things the president and his cabinet members have said?
It's not just about the administration. It's about public officials. It's also about leaders in the community, and it's about the public in general.
So, of course, immigration enforcement is the top priority of this president and this administration. This president is very active on social media, is known for saying inflammatory things. Federal agents have been wearing face coverings. People could be forgiven for interpreting this to be a statement about the administration.
Yeah, and again, that's why I harken back to it, that it's actually not directly pointed at the administration. We feel from our perspective that law enforcement officers are really facing unprecedented scrutiny and hostility in the streets, and we're starting to see attacks on officers again as a result.
Tell me about the concern that this will create confusion, fear, and mistrust among community members. What are you worried about?
Well, again, I go back to, I look at just earlier this late spring, early summer, when we saw the protests out there in L.A. You saw the LAPD officer standing out there in uniform, faces uncovered. Literally, their last names were on tape on their helmets so you could, you know, identify them easily. They had their badge numbers on. And when we see folks out there, whether they're federal agents or they're state or local officers, and they're wearing face coverings and they're not identifying themselves appropriately, one of the our major concerns is blue-on-blue actions, you know, a police officer arriving on a scene because somebody calls and says they see a couple of people out there. I'm not sure exactly who they are. They have face masks on and they're trying to force somebody into a car. And, you know, state or local officers show up and it, whether it's a federal agent or a state or local agent that's not properly identifying themselves, you always worry about those type of incidents there. And also, to be quite honest with you, Ari, we've seen recently where there have been robberies, there's been rapes, there's been, you know, attempted kidnappings as a result of people impersonating both federal agents, you know, specifically really federal agents with masks on.
Does the timing of this have anything to do with a federal takeover of DC police?
No, it didn't. As a matter of fact, the resolutions came out prior to the expansion of federal agents and National Guard in DC.
Terrence Cunningham is the Deputy Executive Director of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ari. I appreciate it.
This year's U.S. Open is a redemption of sorts for one American tennis player, Taylor Townsend. She had early success as a teenager. She is now the top-ranked women's doubles player. But she's faced a tough road, and she's had to overcome an additional hurdle in the past decade, criticism about her body size. Steve Futterman reports.
At the Wimbledon Championships last year,
a very first for Taylor Townsend.
Taylor Townsend won her first Grand Slam event, capturing the doubles title with her partner from the Czech Republic, Kateřina Siniaková.
This is a moment that she will never forget.
This year in January, they won another Grand Slam doubles title in Australia, heard here on the Nine Network.
The number one seeds have claimed the Australian Open. Kateřina Siniaková and Taylor Townsend. Too good in the end.
And then last month, a historic achievement. Townsend became the number one women's doubles player in the world.
You know, it's really special for me to be able to have my friends and family, everyone in this corner. This wouldn't be possible without you guys, so thank you.
For Townsend, it's been a long and sometimes difficult road. At the age of 16 in 2012, she was the top-ranked female juniors player. With an aggressive all-court playing style, everything was looking good. That's when things became complicated. It all had to do with what Taylor Townsend looked like, more specifically, her body type. She was a black teenager who some thought should lose weight and be more fit. Karen Krause is a former reporter for the New York Times who followed Townsend in those early years.
This felt really like the powers that be in the USTA were telling Taylor, no, like, it's not just about your results. It's about what you look like when you're producing these results.
The USTA, the U.S. Tennis Association, took the unusual step of withholding money to pay for Townsend's trip to New York to compete in the 2012 U.S. Open. She was told specifically she needed to lose weight. She went anyway and reached the quarterfinals of the junior singles competition and won the doubles. Still, it took an emotional toll. In 2021, Townsend candidly wrote about it publicly in the Players' Tribune. She said, I'm not thin, and I've never been thin. Her current coach is John Williams.
For Taylor, it was hugely cathartic because she needed to be heard. She needed her story told, and that article was kind of a gateway to that.
Something else happened in 2021. Taylor Townsend gave birth to a baby boy. She is the first mother to be ranked number one in doubles. In her early years on the pro circuit, Townsend was a solid player, especially in doubles, showing flashes of brilliance, but winning few titles. Since opening up about her struggles and becoming a mom, Townsend is having her greatest success.
I've always been this person, but I think for some years I was lost, you know, and lost in a sea of a lot of stuff. But, you know, it's nice to be able to come up to the surface and float and eventually swim.
Next week, Taylor Townsend will compete in both singles and doubles at the U.S. Open, another important milestone as she excels on and off the court. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman.
And you are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:44. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, North Star Stories, produced by Ampers, news stories from communities throughout Minnesota. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Partly cloudy tonight with fog, lows in the upper 50s, dense fog in the morning, then mostly sunny. Highs near 81 with calm wind. For Thursday, mostly sunny, highs 80 to 85, slight chance for afternoon showers in the Bemidji area. The Eveleth Elks Club has a corn feed and classic car show this Friday from 4:30 to 7 at the corner of Grant Avenue and Jones Street. Proceeds benefit the Elks Youth Scholarship Fund. Let us know what's happening in your community. Email us psa@kaxe.org.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota,
why some Minnesotans are losing housing protections. Then, what experts say about a toxic algae bloom in the Northern Lakes. And a warning about two new scams targeting seniors. I'm Chantel Sings. The Minnesota Department of Human Services, or DHS, is ending its Housing Stabilization Services program. The program was designed to help people with disabilities, including those with mental illness or substance use disorders, and seniors, find and keep housing. According to the DHS temporary commissioner, the program has been plagued by widespread allegations and evidence of fraud. The agency is now working to redesign and relaunch the benefit with input from the legislature, providers, community partners, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. DHS is notifying enrollees, service recipients, and providers about the change. In today's main story, warm temperatures are creating toxic algae in the Northern Lakes. Maya Hecht talks to experts about the consequences for humans and the environment.
Toxic algae blooms are becoming more common in Lake Superior. Cyanobacteria, the organism driving the blooms, occur naturally in these ecosystems. However, some cyanobacteria can make people sick and kill pets and fish. It can even kill livestock.
Having these toxic cyanobacterial species present, that creates a whole other can of worms.
That's Cody Sheik, associate biology professor at the University of Minnesota Duluth. He works with freshwater lake scientist Chris Filstrup, who said,
we tend to see them during warmer times of the year just from a seasonal perspective.
Although the largest and coldest of the Great Lakes, Superior is also the fastest warming.
It's going to move away from the optimal growth conditions of things that grow in colder waters, right? Things like diatoms.
Diatoms, a type of algae, produce oxygen, so much that they are responsible for every fourth breath you take. And they struggle as temperatures warm.
Certain cyanobacteria can float to the surface and like shade out everything underneath that.
This shading out blocks sunlight and uses up available oxygen.
And what that causes is a lot of fish kills and things like deaths of other macroinvertebrates.
But the interest of this research extends beyond just the Big Lake.
One other perspective I want to add to this from our farming community. In previous areas where I've worked, you would get a call from a family farm operation that maybe has 40 head of cattle, and 10 of them die from drinking contaminated water that is due to toxic cyanobacteria blooms in that stock tank.
However, support for this kind of research has been uncertain. Funding cuts for National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration programs like Sea Grant are on the horizon for 2026.
Yeah, we've been kind of like sitting on the edges of our seats for a lot of our projects.
Biologist Cody Sheik said there are ways the public can help.
Seeing these blooms and responding to them is actually really, really helpful. If people just take a picture and like a screen grab of, you know, their coordinates of where they're at.
It's definitely something to look out for.
Abby Smason is a grad student on Cody's lab team at UMD. In June, they made an exciting discovery in Duluth Harbor.
Basically, what we found was a genome for Microcystis aeruginosa.
Microcystis aeruginosa is a type of bacteria. In a lab, they got a close look at its DNA. For the first time, they confirmed that it was producing the same toxins linked to sickening people and animals.
It is helpful to know that there's not just one species that can make this toxin that we knew was in the harbor.
This discovery places researchers one step further along the way to understanding what causes blooms and what we can expect as our climate changes. Maya Hecht for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Itasca County Sheriff's Office in northern Minnesota is warning about two new scams targeting Minnesotans. In one case, someone is pretending to be a representative of Medicare. Medicare provides health insurance for individuals over the age of 65. In the other scam, someone is claiming to represent Publishers Clearinghouse, which is actually a free online sweepstakes and more popular among older adults. The sheriff's office says the scams are very convincing and that residents should be incredibly cautious. Scammers often target seniors because they typically have more money saved, and many tend to be more trusting.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In France, the latest controversy isn't about taxes, the retirement age, or even cuts to precious summer vacations. It's about air conditioning. Europe's summers are getting hotter, and some say turn on the AC, while others say mais non. NPR's Rebecca Rossman reports from Paris.
It all started on a hot, very hot summer day in late June with a declaration that seemed benign enough. Air conditioning saves lives, far-right party leader Marine Le Pen told French TV channel BFM in the midst of a 100-degree heat wave. She therefore found it, quote, totally absurd that the majority of hospitals and schools still don't have it. 1,800 schools had to close during the heat wave, according to the government. Le Pen said if elected one day, she would install AC units across the country. Then came the response from France's ecologist party.
Est-ce que je suis par contre en train de vous dire que la clim est la solution partout? Non, les écoles. Si on peut les climatiser, faisons-le.
Speaking to France Info Radio, Green Party Secretary Marine Tondelier said she wasn't against installing air conditioning in schools and hospitals, but she insisted it doesn't have to be the only solution.
Je rappelle quand même que le principal problème, c'est que les écoles ne sont pas isolées.
Tondelier said the real problem is poor insulation, which is why her party is pushing for more investment in energy-efficient buildings. A recent Opinion Way poll found only about half of the French public think all public spaces should be air-conditioned. Only a quarter of French households have AC units, compared to 90% in the U.S.
If I had to sum up, I can say that the left is against air conditioners and the right is in favor air conditioner.
That's economist Nicolas Bouzou. In a recent op-ed for the French paper Le Figaro, Bouzou argued air conditioning isn't just about comfort, it's about productivity.
It's very difficult to work, it's very difficult to study, and at the end of the day, it's very difficult to struggle against the climate crisis.
And since most of France's energy is nuclear, he says the country can stay cool without warming the planet. Here in Paris, 8 out of the 10 hottest summers on record have been in the last decade. Still, on this 90-degree afternoon, Parisians stretched out along the Seine, seeming unbothered, like 73-year-old writer Philippe Mezisques. I ask how he feels about the idea of more air conditioning in France, particularly after a series of 100-degree heat waves this summer. To which he says he's mostly against it. AC wastes a lot of energy, he says. Why not just open a window? Others are straight up offended by the question.
So what do you think of air conditioning?
I don't like this. I don't like it. I don't have.
And then there's Peter Soderbaum, an Australian who says he's baffled the French are even debating this.
What's the discussion on air conditioning in Australia?
There is no discussion. You have air conditioning.
Soderbaum has reluctantly adapted to France's air conditioning phobia. He says he keeps a fan in his home and uses blackout curtains to keep out sunlight during the day. But he also believes the French are delaying the inevitable.
Like, it will come, whether they want it or not.
France and Europe is getting hotter, perhaps too hot to live without the AC. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, Paris.
No one wants rats scurrying around their neighborhood, but they are a cunning and ever-evasive foe. Now a community near Boston is trying a different approach, rat birth control. Reporter Ari Daniel has more.
I'm outside a school in Somerville, Massachusetts, with a few locals, and seems like everyone's got a horror story about the rats here, like Adeline Lining.
I get like the beautiful Bartlett pears every Christmas, and this year they were on my porch for 2 hours. And then my neighbor texted me a picture and was like, you probably don't want these anymore. No, I don't want them anymore because there were rats inside the box feasting on my Christmas pears.
It was a delivery.
Yeah, it was a delivery.
And they ruined Christmas.
They did.
Rats are crazy.
Andrew Jeffries says he can't unremember the noises he heard at his last apartment.
All night in the summer, the rats would like scream.
As they like bathed in your trash?
Yeah, we like requested new trash cans. They ate through like the bottom and the top.
Besides being nuisances, the rodents cause real problems. Alicia Privett is Somerville's environmental health coordinator, AKA the city's rat czar.
Rats can carry diseases, mostly leptospirosis, hantavirus, and then they also are one of the leading causes of property damage.
Due to the way they chew through wires, fencing, decks, even cinder block to keep their incisors trim, not to mention their extensive underground tunneling. One local health official told me when the subway was extended a mile in the 80s in neighboring Cambridge, the digging unearthed thousands of rat tunnels.
They're like my ultimate nemesis. You gotta admire their tenaciousness, their ability to adapt.
People like Privet have thrown all sorts of things at the problem, trying to keep rat numbers down and their vandalism contained. But residents don't always follow best practices, and the rats, they outwit our traps, penetrate so-called impenetrable containers.
In my opinion, I don't think anything's rat-proof because they're just so scrappy.
And even attempts at poisoning can backfire when pets or raptors eat the rats or the bait and get sick or die. So Somerville's trying something else, an anti-fertility chemical that targets female rats.
So it basically stops the pregnancy before it starts.
Sam Lipson is the senior director of environmental health in Cambridge, and he's overseeing a field trial of the chemical in Cambridge and here in Somerville. Lipson says the birth control doesn't lead to permanent infertility, only while it's circulating in the rat's bloodstream. The goal, however, is not total eradication.
That is not going to happen. The idea of bringing the sea level down is sort of the way I think about it, because other types of bait and efforts to minimize rat activity are going to be way more successful if you can bring the overall population down.
So Lipson and his colleagues are testing whether this chemical, when dispensed in bait boxes in a dense and variable urban environment, might lead to less overall rat activity.
And if we find that it does, I think we'll make that part of our city strategy.
All right, let's go get this started.
The field trial relies on community volunteers, and Alicia Privet's leading four of them on an orientation.
We're gonna head over this way.
She walks through how to look for rodent activity and check the bait boxes that are in a handful of people's yards in this part of Somerville.
You just push in, it'll pop up.
Over the course of a year or so, the city will gauge whether the approach helps. Danine Williams, a longtime resident of Somerville, is one of the volunteers. Her job will be to search out evidence of rats and fill the boxes with the anti-fertility bait.
I have no illusion that we can actually outsmart the rats, but if we could just reduce them, that would be good.
She calls her involvement a form of resistance. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BritBox, presenting Outrageous, a new BritBox original drama based on the scandalous true story of England's infamous Mitford sisters. Streaming this and more original series at BritBox.com. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. at uma.com/NPR. From Subaru, who along with its retailers is partnering with AdoptAClassroom.org to provide funding to high-need schools and local communities for the Subaru Loves Learning Initiative. Subaru, more than a car company. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective, and at 7, John Henningsgaard, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing, announcing the release of the new Full Stinger Variety Pack, featuring the Blood Orange IPA and Lemon Drop Blonde, available in liquor stores now. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Partly cloudy today.